So let's begin. We're going to basically take up and finish off the second half of the Rambam's introduction to his commentary on Mishnayos. And as you'll see, there's a lot of other, certainly somewhat controversial and very, very fascinating insights that the Rambam reveals about his approach to learning and to Gemara that you'll see throughout this second part. So let's take it away. So if you recall, the Rambam, or we left off with, that there are five types of laws, okay? So the first one, the first category are those laws that are were heard directly from Moshe, and you could also derive them using the tools that were given at Sinai. So if you recall, according to the Rambam, not only, let's say when it came to a lulav, not only was the specific palm frond shown to Moshe Rabbeinu and said, this is what a lulav looks like, but there was also a method using Yud Gimel Midos, et cetera, to come to the same conclusion that a lulav means a palm frond. So that's one category. The second one is the same thing heard from Moshe, and you could derive with Svara, but there'd be some argument about how to get to that conclusion. So that was category two. Category three is Halacha L'Moshe MiSinai. Recall, those are laws where there is no method of coming to that conclusion. For instance, the idea of a kezias. A kezias is not something that you could deduce. And all the other, he lists all the Halacha L'Moshe MiSinais. There are gzeros, okay, which are, the way I like to put it is, they are usually restrictions that are put in place to protect the Torah system. So that's why they're a geder. They surround the Torah system. And finally, you have takanos and menhagim. Takanos, which seem to be more they're both responsive. Takanos where, let's say like prisbal, for example, there's a problem taking place and now halacha is being followed. And menhagim also are there to either bring into the halachic system common practices like finances, or to help in our overall, adherence to mitzvahs. All of these five laws, okay, and this now we get the transition into Mishnah, all of these five types of laws can be found in Mishnayos. You will see all of them in various Mishnayos, okay, in all different degrees, okay? So, now the Rambam moves into what the actual format of a Mishnah is, okay? So, now that you know the content of the Mishnah, being the Aristotelian that he is, now you want to understand the Tzura, the format of what a Mishnah is. So how is the Mishnah structured? So first of all, the Mishnah must always include an accurate recording of the various debates that took place, okay? Why? Why is it so important? Why is it so critical to ensure that there's an accurate transmission of the debates themselves, okay? The reason why, he says, is because let's assume, okay, that X is the only one that's cited in the Mishnah, okay? So someone else could come along and say, yeah, but one second, my Masorah is Y. My Masorah is not what you found in Mishnah as X, but my Masorah is Y. Now again, when they say my Masorah, they don't mean like what people say today when they say they have a Masorah, like I have a Masorah not to eat cheese during Pesach. That's not what they're talking about. What they're saying is that there's a legitimate, so to speak, there's an accurate Masorah transmission that I can trace back that shows that Y is a possible outcome, okay? If that's the case, now you're going to have a problem. You're going to have a discrepancy where it says X is the halacha, but someone else says I have an oral transmission back to whatever Sinai that says Y is the halacha. Such a thing can't happen, and therefore the Rambam says the Mishnah must record what it called each argument. Now there is an irony. There's an irony in the Rambam's insistence, so to speak. I mean, he's not wrong, but in seeing Mishnayos in that way. What's the irony? It's a very funny irony. So down the road, we'll get to Kreskes's introduction to Or LaHashem, but one of his harshest criticisms on the Rambam is that when the Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam did not include an accurate transmission of the various arguments, okay? Meaning, the Rambam insisted the Mishnah contained that, but when the Rambam wrote his Mishnah Torah, the Rambam basically says, this is what you're supposed to do. On occasion, he'll throw in a machlokas, but 99% of the time, he literally is cutting out the entire Masoretic stream. Whereas the Rif, as an example, which the Rambam will bring down soon, the Rif does include the accurate transmission and accurate recording of debates. So it's very funny how the Rambam emphasizes the trouble that can emerge by not, what he called, accurately depicting the various arguments, and yet he himself, the Rambam himself, in his Sefer, did not record those very arguments. And he was criticized harshly by Chassei Kreskes. Okay, so we're all familiar with this. What are the six divisions of Mishnayos? So the Rambam explains there's the agricultural section, there's times of years, it's Moed, sexual relations, civil law, temple service, and ritual purity. I think we're all familiar with that. These are the six divisions of the Mishnah. Okay, we'll get into Masechtas in a second. Now the Rambam spends some time going over why there's an order here. Now it's interesting, the Gemara itself, okay, there's a tension in various Gemaras about whether there is a Seder to Mishnayos, so to speak, or not. Okay, meaning, in other words, is there when Rav Yehuda Nasi put A after B, did he do it for a clear reason, or it didn't have to be that way? The Rambam insists that there's an order not only to the overall tractates, meaning the books themselves, but even within each book, why, let's say, it starts off with Brachos first, or why it starts off with Shabbos by Moed, all these things he's going to explain as well. So he says why they start off, now why have the first book, Zraim, agricultural? Because you need food to live, right? The most basic thing that man requires is sustenance. Now, of course, with sustenance, that's going to lead him to be able to worship. And if he's in a state of mind to worship, now he has to know what times he's supposed to worship. So Moed follows Zraim, okay? Now that I'm in the Torah and I'm already thinking about the various things I have to do in the Torah, okay? Now it turns out in the Torah, the next thing in order is that the Torah talks about sexual prohibitions. After that, we get civil law, and that brings Shmos to an end, okay? Vayikra begins with temple service, and it also has in there laws about Tumah and Tara. Now, if we really start to nitpick here, we notice that in this summary, it's not 100% accurate. For example, the actual temple service begins technically in Parshas Truma with the construction of the Mishkan. So it's not quite as smooth as the Rambam wants to make it to be, but he is attempting to demonstrate that there is an order, that don't think that Moed comes out to Zraim for no reason. He tries to apply his creativity and try to show sort of a theme. The only issue is that there's the first two really are more based in, like, I'd say, a Svara. The other ones are more based in that once you're in the Torah, you follow a certain order. So the order didn't have to be that way. It's like secondary that happened to go in that order in the Torah. Now, of course, as we all know, when you look at each Sefer, right, there are subdivisions, which we call Masechtas. So, for example, Brachos, okay? Now, why did Brachos come first in Zraim? So, again, I have this book all about agricultural stuff. You ever wonder why Brachos comes first? Brachos doesn't seem to belong there. Oh, he tells you why. A person eats first when following a medical regimen, and therefore must know to make a bracha before eating, okay? Shabbos, the greatest of all days, is an astronomical certainty, so must come at the beginning of Moed. Yevamos, this is a funny one, Yevamos comes first in Nashim because you start with an act that someone is forced to do, which is Yibum, right? A person, in fact, Beis Din can force the brother to try and marry the other one unless it's a chalitza. Unlike marriage, which you're not compelled to marry someone else, it's a mitzvah. So he gives all, and of course, Avos, why is Avos there at all? So Avos is there, it's demonstrative of the Mesorah, and it presents the ethical teaching of the sages. So the Rambam actually, he spends a lot of time on this, that's just like a few examples. The Rambam goes in great detail explaining the order of all these things, that there's an actual order to every single thing, and don't just stand there, Yehuda Nasi kind of closes eyes and threw darts at a dartboard. Rather, he actually thought very deeply into why the book should go in a certain order, and within those books, why one should precede the other. And that's something he really emphasizes. Okay. Now, what started happening, though? Okay. So, now, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, when he wrote all this stuff down in the Mishnayos, all these books with the various Masechtas inside, to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, all this was extremely clear. Okay. Remember, the Rambam maintains that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was a master of Lashon Kodesh, brilliant, well-respected, wealthy. You know, he was the guy. And he has certain insight and clarity of thinking that the Rambam would argue, okay, again, this is the key point here, in his eyes, when he wrote the Mishnah, it all made perfect sense to him. Okay, when Yehuda Nasi wrote the Mishnayos, to him, it was 100% crystal clear what was going on. But of course, okay, to those of us who are not on his level, when you read a Mishnah, it seems very cryptic. Okay, so now there's a problem now. Rav Yehuda Nasi accomplishes a certain objective of running down the Mishnayos to ensure that Jews can know Torah and Torah Shabbat Peh, etc. But the problem is, what was clear to him becomes much more difficult to us. Now, this doesn't mean Kahati steps in. Kahati is much later on. Rather, what happens? The Tosefta is written. The Tosefta is written by Rav Chiya and Rav Oshia. It was written in order to elucidate the Mishnah. So the purpose of a Tosefta, which if you look at most Gemara volumes today, I can only speak of the Tzuras Adaf, the Vilna one, you always find in the back Toseftas, okay? And Gemaras often cite them. They're there to help elucidate the Mishnah. Rav stepped in and wrote Sifra and Sifra to also, elucidate the Mishnah. So you have these attempts by people lower than Rav Yehuda Nasi to write volumes to go ahead and help make the Mishnah clearer. The problem was is that, and this is amazing, the Rambam says this, whereas there were very good commentaries, although that's questionable if you ever read these, but anyway, they're very good at assisting and trying to help out with the Mishnah. The problem is they didn't write them in a very organized way. Toseftas are not written, according to the Rambam, in the same smooth order that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi organized the Mishnayos in. So what you gain in a Tosefta of bringing clarity to some cryptic Mishnah, you lose insofar as the overall thematic structure of how they put the Toseftas together. That's how the Rambam looks at that, okay? So now what do we have in front of us, okay? And that's why the Akdamah of the Perash Mishnayos is phenomenal for giving us a beautiful history, brief, but a beautiful history of the construction of the Mishnah. We have the Mishnah, we have Toseftas, Sifri and Sifra, all there to help buttress the Mishnah, okay? The next step down is the Gemara. Now comes the Gemara. What happens with the Talmud? So what ends up happening is that you start having disagreements among rabbis as to how to explain the content of the Mishnah, okay? Ravina, Ravashi, and it really was more Ravashi than Ravina, what do? So they spend their years collecting together all the various statements and insights that were developed in regards to understanding the content of the Mishnah. So they're collators. I mean, they were also obviously commented themselves, but they collate together all the various information over years of debate over what exactly the Mishnah is talking about, okay? And that becomes the basis for Gemara. Okay, so now, what are the objectives, okay? The objectives of the Gemara are to explain the Mishnah, okay? What are the Rambam's now? Now the Rambam moves over to his objectives, okay, in writing what it called the Perash Mishnayos. So we have already, and again, now is a perfect time for him to bring this up because he's established already how you have Tosefta, Sifra, Sifra, and Gemara, which are all there in some way to help explain what's going on in the Mishnah. So if that's the case, if they're all there to explain the Mishnah, what the heck's the Rambam doing? Okay? What is the Rambam doing? What's he there for? So in other words, how could the Rambam write a commentary on the Mishnah when we already have in place commentaries on the Mishnah? We have Toseftas. Okay, so the Rambam says, he'll tell you what his objectives are. Number one, the Rambam wants to also explain Mishnayos. He feels he has the ability to do that. He also wants to help establish Psak. Now that's very important, okay, because in other words, the Rambam is very careful in how he deals with what we call Stima Sashas. Stima Sashas refers to, I'd almost argue, a phenomenon that really has no clear basis as like a moment in time, but rather it's an idea that we consider that once the Gemara was sealed, once it was completed, so then Pesach was set in place, okay? Meaning that we accept whatever the Pesach of the Gemara was. But there's a couple issues with that. Number one, that's not actually true. There was no actual Sanhedrin that ever got together and said, this is now the Pesach for Klal Yisrael. It was never a meeting of all the judges to determine such a thing. I'm not minimizing that our following of Gemara. I'm just saying it wasn't like a Durabanan. It wasn't like Sanhedrin said, there was no Sanhedrin, but Sanhedrin said, oh, you know what? The Gemara, this has become the book that we rely on for Psak. That never happened. Number two, as we know, the Gemara itself sometimes isn't so clear as so far as what the Psak is. Okay? So the Rambam first wants to offer his own explanation of Mishnayos. He wants to help establish the Psak. He wants to make sure that you know what the Psak is. He also wants to introduce new interpretations of Mishnah, along with methods of extrapolation. Okay? Okay, now here comes the other thing. Now, Gemaras contain drushos, and the Rambam is going to start going off on this. Why do Gemara contain drushos? Okay? What are drushos doing in Gemara? Why do the Gemara contain drushos? Okay? I can understand when it comes to understanding what the halakha is going to be, and the Rambam is going to write his commentary to elucidate that, but I can understand the Gemara is there to record these debates about how to understand the Mishnah, etc. But why are drushos in there? Why are agaditas inside Gemara? What are they doing there? So again, we know in the content of Gemara we have brisas, as people have already written a couple times. We have these brisas, which the Rambam doesn't touch on what those are specifically, but we have these notes that all talk about content of the Mishnah. We have debates. We have all these different things. But you have this whole section, which we'll call, let's say, non-halacha, philosophy, psychology, medical stuff, whatever it might be. All these weird things, okay, that don't really, don't really belong in Gemara. So the Rambam says, he says, Ein lachshoshu kal chashivas. Don't mock and belittle the drushos. Because why would you do that? Because you'd see these statements, these agaditas, and you think to yourself, this is foolish. I mean, this doesn't make any sense. So the Rambam says, and this is a common answer given, the drushos contain very, very deep wisdom. They have the tremendous amount of chachmah contained inside these drushos. A wise person, right, through studying drushos, will find very, very deep theological concepts. So when you sit down with an agadita, which may sound like fairy tales, truth, deep inside it somewhere lies some sort of deep, important concept in philosophy. Whereas a fool will look at an agata, and this is the key thing, he'll discard them due to taking them literally. That's another critical point, which, of course, as we know, puts the Rambam in one camp against, certainly later on, you don't say as much in Rishonim, but much later on, another camp, which is that you should take these things literally. The Rambam obviously was very opposed to taking agatas literally, but the problem is that if you don't take them literally, so then the question is, what's the point of them? So you're kind of trapped, okay? So the Rambam explains that what a Chacham does is that, what does he do? He writes in this cryptic style because he wants to make sure, this is interesting, that the average person should never have easy access to the ideas that are contained, that the Chacham wants to give over. So let's say, for instance, the Chacham has some deep idea about how black holes work, okay? But he doesn't want the average person to be able to just open up a Gemara and see this idea outright. Rather, what does he want? He wants that idea to be hidden. So you could get there, but you need a certain methodology of how to get to that conclusion. That's how the Rambam looks at these agaditas. He looks at them as things containing very, very deep ideas, okay? But only for someone who's really trained in doing that. And that's what the Rambam emphasizes, that there's a methodology that exists for a person to uncover these deep ideas and agaditas, okay? He doesn't actually tell you what that is, but he does say that if someone went ahead and spent time learning Gemara, the more you learn regular Gemara, the more you'll understand how to access these agaditas and these drushas in Gemara itself. Yeah, go ahead, Zoe. You are picking up a very good point, which is the Rambam, he's very consistent. Rambam's always consistent about this idea of that there's what's written down, and then there's the methodology, like a certain methodology that if a person develops to get, so to speak, underneath the words or the deeper point. So just like he has that by Mishnayos, but he claims those were given at Sinai, this is not talking about Sinai stuff. The methodology here is more about when a person sees the back and forth and how Gemara is structured and engages in understanding Machlokasim and Svara. So the more he's involved in that, he'll then be able to focus himself and understand how to access those ideas in the drushas themselves, okay? Which therefore means that there's a link. There's a link between the methodology that a person uses in understanding regular Gemara that links into accessing these ideas in a Gadita. That's an important point. Meaning what the Rambam's trying to show you is, don't look at the study of a Gadita as being a separate phenomenon from the study of Gemara itself. He wants them to be linked together. Not everyone agrees with that, but the Rambam wants to show you that there's an underlying link between the Agadatas, the Drushas, and what are they called, and regular Gemara. Okay, now the Rambam switches gears. Okay, and this is a this is something that, on the surface, when you, if you were reading the Hakdama, you would ask yourself, what is going on here? Because it's like he completely stops the whole process of the history of Gemara and why he's writing Perek Rishonis, etc., to bring up a very, very different point. Okay, and what's that point? So the point he gets to is what I call the ancient version of the principle of sufficient reason. Now, I'm not going to get too much into how this works in philosophy, but or is what I call PSR. PSR is a critical tool that all of us use. We just don't realize it, but it's a critical tool that many philosophers rely on. And basically, in the ancient version of it, it basically means that everything that exists in the world or in the universe must have a purpose for its existence. Now, it's important to emphasize that doesn't mean I'm trying to find out why God did it. It just means that if there's a chair here, by virtue of me calling it a chair, it has a purpose, which is for me, for people to sit on it. So everything in the universe, everything I look at must have, let's just keep it simple, by Earth. Everything on Earth must have a purpose for its existence. Okay, that's the Rambam's premise. You don't have to buy that premise. You run into all sorts of interesting problems if you deny it. But the Rambam wants us to accept that as a premise. And that's actually, you can find that quite often in Aristotelian philosophy and among Islamic philosophers, the idea of everything that exists must have a purpose. Now, if that's the case, what we also know is that God, when he created the universe, okay, he created some things where the purpose of that object is hidden from us, right? So again, we know that, and the Rambam expands on this in the Mora, we know that God, everything that God does must have a purpose, okay? Therefore, we also know that there could be things in the universe that we look at, and we don't quite see what the purpose is. We have to believe that there's a purpose there, and God hid that purpose from us. Okay, but through investigation and discovery, we may be able to actually uncover what the purpose is. Now, a prophet, okay, could actually be the one to expose those hidden reasons, okay? But rational thinking cannot. So if I come across an object and I can't understand its purpose for existence, rational thinking will not be able to bring, there's no way I can work out a svara or creative thinking to find the purpose for it, okay? Why is he saying that? Okay, so that's very nice. Great. So what's he getting at? So the main point that Rambam's bringing up now is that everything on Earth was created for humanity's usage. So that's the next big jump he takes. That everything I look around the world, okay, everything here exists for, what's the purpose of everything? For humanity. It's for us to make use of it, right? So everything. I'm not talking about an atom, although you can even argue an atom because it's for man to study. But the point is, everything that exists, it's a very geocentric view, is there for our usage, okay? But if that's true, the Rambam wants to know, what is our purpose? If everything then has a purpose, what is the purpose of the existence of humanity itself? Now, that's a very common thing you do with PSR, is that you take it, apply it to a specific, and then move to the category. So what's the purpose of humanity, okay? So he says like this, he says, now, when a person's involved in satisfying their instinctual needs, right? Meaning when people, and you'll see how he's about to condemn 99% of humanity. When a person's life is one where all they're doing is hedonism, like instinctual stuff, they're like an animal, okay? The only action, there's one thing, okay, that really identifies the purpose of our existence. And that is when we use our mind, to our intellect, to uncover truth. So as long as we are using our minds to uncover truth, we are living in line with in line of the purpose of our existence. Okay, that is very consistent. Remember, the Rambam wrote this young when he was young. That's very consistent with the Rambam's philosophy throughout all his works. The idea that the ultimate state for humanity to be in is when you're using the intellect. Okay, engaging in wisdom is the actualization of our potential. But on the other hand, though, the more we indulge in the instinctual world, the more our intellect shrinks. So what's the purpose of the existence of humanity? It's for us to go ahead. Our purpose is to use our minds to uncover truth. That's it. It's as easy as that, okay? Now, the Rambam therefore says, if everything created indeed has a purpose, okay, and if humanity's purpose is executed when humanity is involved in intellectual discovery, How do you explain the, now I'm using billions for today, how do you explain the billions of people who are, in the Rambam's eyes, sophisticated animals? Again, the Rambam says that the only people, the only time humanity is living in line with its purpose is when it is thinking, okay? When it's involved in pursuing truth, uncovering reality, okay? But let's be honest, if we look around, 99% of people are just not doing that on a daily basis. So the question then is, why would God, it's an amazing Rambam asks this, and you'll be very disappointed by one of his answers, or maybe by both. But he says, why would God create humanity, right, in such a way, so to speak, where most of humanity is never engaged in this intellectual pursuit? So what are they? I mean, they're sophisticated animals, and that's it. So what's the purpose of them? So the Rambam says two reasons. Number one, he says like this. He says, the people who are supposed to be involved in thinking, they can't be bothered by things like plowing and planting and harvesting and making shirts and whatever. All these mundane actions, the wise person needs to focus all his life on thinking. He has to be in a think tank. That's where the wise person belongs. He can't be distracted by things like a regular, you know, average Joe stuff, right? That's not for the wise person. So according to the Rambam, the first reason is everyone exists in the world, right, to serve the Chachav, okay? So when in the Rambam's version, when the person in the sweatshop in wherever in India is making Nike shoes, he's doing it so the Chacham wouldn't have to be in that same situation, okay? Now, that's a very, very, very difficult concept to understand. But the Rambam does say that is the purpose of 99% of humanity. They're there to serve the wise person, okay? But what's amazing is that the second reason he gives is that you can't ask why God does things. This has been a famous question on the Rambam's entire Hagdama, which is that, first of all, why would he even ask the question to begin with if the answer is going to be, we don't ask why God does things? And second of all, why didn't he make that the second reason? He should have made that the first reason, which is, we never ask why God does things. So it's very funny, this second answer, he's ultimately acknowledging, possibly, that his first answer is not exactly a very compelling answer. But ultimately, the Rambam does believe that either we have no idea why, right, or that the people are there to really serve the needs of the wise person. They're there so he doesn't have to worry about what it takes to, mundane actions. Very, very controversial perspective on humanity. Okay, so now after that tangent, which, by the way, the Rambam himself says, Ugvar Hisrahachnu Me'od, Me'in Shiratzino. He's a very funny writer, because like, it's like he's writing, he's like, oh, this is something I just thought about. He writes down a complete tangent and then apologizes, okay, for having gone off on that tangent. So now he's like, let's get back to work, okay? He apologizes and says, what does Rav Ashi do? Rav Ashi, back to the Gemara. Rav Ashi goes ahead, and what does he do? He finishes compiling 35 volumes of Talmud Bavli. And as we know, not all the tractates of Mishnah are included, okay? And Rav Yochanan does the same thing in Israel with the Talmud Yerushalmi, okay? Which the Rambam says was really collected in 5 volumes. So what you end up having is that you have a Talmud Bavli put together and a Talmud Yerushalmi. Okay, now as you know, he's going to focus on the Bavli. As we all know, the Bavli was not complete. It was not complete. So, for example, what happens to Taros? We never have Gemara. We don't have a Masechta on Kalim or on Oholos. It doesn't exist. We have it in Mishnayos, but we don't have Gemara. Okay? So the Rambam says, I'll tell you why they never made a Masechta out of it. So number one, Taros requires a ton of work and analysis. Okay? Anyone who's been through Mishnayos and Taros knows it's extremely difficult to understand what's going on. Okay? He says you can use Toseftas to help you understand. And you also can use, right, the mentioning of Taharos in other sections of Gemara. So it's not that there's no idea of Taharos at all in Gemaras. We can find in various Gemaras, you'll see, rayas brought in or questions about mikvah or whatever it might be. You'll find Taharos scattered throughout Gemara. But ultimately, it's because of the difficulty, right? They didn't have set up their own Masechta, but the Rambam does maintain that if you studied Toseftas, and you studied all the other mentions of Taros in Gemara, right, and put in basically probably your whole life, you will master the area of Taharos. Almost as if to say, you didn't need a separate Masechta. That's also a very difficult answer. It's very difficult. I mean, again, he's trying to explain it as best he can, but it's still, in my opinion, not 100% satisfying why you couldn't have a separate section on Taharos. I do think, though, the first point he makes is probably the best one, which is that of all the areas in Halacha, Taharos is purely abstract. It's extremely difficult and complex, multi-layered. And so it could be that ultimately they didn't want, they realized that people would never be able to access those areas. Okay, so the Rambam does say, right, there was a moment where the Gemara is sealed, but not insofar as Psak, but rather insofar as you can't change the Gemara itself anymore. Once the Gemara is sealed, there's no adding and no taking away from the Gemara itself, much like the Torah Shebichtav. Okay, fine. Again, he's very careful about his position on Psak. Now, what happens now? He skips the Sabarayim and gets to the Gaonim, but he probably included them in the Gaonim as well. The Gaonim step up. Now, what do? So they write some small commentaries on Gemara. Okay, now, as we know, the Gaon did more than that. Okay, but the Rambam says, you know, a couple points here, a couple points there, nothing too substantial on the Gemara itself. Until the Rif comes along. So the Rif becomes a tremendous visionary in what he tries to do with Gemara. Because what does he do? He's the first person to actually codify the Halacha while keeping the Mesorah intact. So as, again, in using the Vilna Shas, and in the Shas Pnimim, when you go to the back, you'll see the Dapei HaRif. I remember when I was a kid, and I first saw Dapei HaRif, it looks exactly like the regular Gemara. And so far as the print's concerned. Except for the fact that instead of, you have Rashi in smaller Rashi letters, and if, let's say, you're in Brachos, you'll have Rabbeinu Yonah. If you're in Shabbos, you'll have the Ran. But it's set up exactly like Gemara. It looks exactly like Gemara. What does the Rif do? The Rif goes ahead and wants us to know what the Halacha Lemaisa is, but he gets rid of the Drushos, the stuff the Rambam says is so important, he ignores. He does record the Mesorah correctly. Okay, and then the Rambam says something funny. He says, the good news is that, don't worry, the Rif only made like around 10 mistakes or less. So he did a great job. Like, it's a very funny writer. Rambam writes in a very funny way. He's like, I salute the Rif for doing a great job. Yeah, he didn't make more than 10 mistakes in his big compilation. But what the Rif did was very important. So now the Rambam swings back to, again, now why he's writing this entire thing. Because we have commentaries on Mishnah, right, with Toseftas and stuff like that. We have that. So he's saying now what he's doing, what's his objective? He says like this, back to Mishnayos, when it comes to studying Mishnayos on their own, as we know, if I study Mishnayos pure without Gemara, without Tosefta, that's Sifrin and Sifra, I don't know what's going on, okay, without Kahati, we don't know what's going on. So according to the Rambam, I can't use a Svara to really understand the complexity, to manage the and master the complexity of Mishnayos. I can't. Right? Gemara I could, but not Mishnayos themselves, okay? So Mishnayos on their own, I can't just use rational speculation to really get to the heart of what a Mishnah is about. And not only that, there are concepts and terms that are used throughout the Mishnayos and no one understands at all. No one understands these words. They don't understand the concepts that the Mishnayos are referring to. So now the Rambam, going back to it now, concretizes his four objectives in writing the Perish Mishnayos. And this will bring us to the end of the Hakdama. So the first objective is, okay, it's very simple. You will finally know the correct interpretation of the Mishnah. All right, so forget the Gemara, forget the Tosefta, forget the Sifra and Sifra. If you want to know what the Mishnah really means, the Perish Mishnayos is the commentary that you want to use, okay? Now, come on. You can't be expected to know all the Gemara. See, the Rambam would acknowledge that if you knew Shas cold, you wouldn't necessarily need the Perish Mishnayos. Right, but not everyone knows all of Gemara. So since not everyone knows all of Gemara, the Perish of Mishnayos is there to help us out. That's the first reason the Rambam lists. And the second one, he says, I want to tell you, the final decisions of Mishnayos. Like he says, Shani Omer Lecha Hapsakim, Shani Omer Lecha Alidei Perish Kol Halacha Kedas Mi Hamaseh. Because he wants to tell you, who do we Paskin like? You need to know who you Paskin like. So if you ever look at the Perish Mishnayos, he does that often. He'll explain the Mishnah, and in the end, they'll say, Halacha k'so-and-so, okay? So, again, it's important, we sometimes forget, the objectives of Mishnayos initially, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, wasn't just to write down the Torah Shebaal Peh, but it was to create a system so that all of B'nai Yisrael would know what the halacha is. All right, so the Rambam realizes that as clear as it was to Rav Yehuda Nasi, for the average Jew, they're not going to want to know what's going on. They're not going to know what to do. So the Rambam says, so you fulfill an objective of the Mishnah, of the Mishnayos, by making sure everyone knows what the final psak of each Mishnah is. And finally, excuse me, the third objective is, he says, a person by reading his commentary will now start to begin to refine how they think, okay? Because it's like training you for that deep thinking that Gemara requires. So if you want to do that that warm-up session, right, to get good at Gemara, right, you'll want to study the Perish Mishnayos first. The Perish Mishnayos is the training regimen necessarily for a person to go ahead and really engage in Gemara. And finally, his last objective is that basically, and this is very interesting, he says that the commentary will help people remember what they learned in Mishnayos, okay? In a sense, it's like a mnemonic. He wants to use the Perish Mishnayos to help you remember Mishnayos, right? It's a method to help remember what's in the Mishnayos themselves. So by simplifying what's contained in the Mishnayos, a person will be better suited to remember the content itself. Finally, the Rambam actually spends about 10, 12 pages on this, but it's only one slide worth. The Rambam's, the last thing he does is that he lists 10 various appendices prior to beginning the commentary. So he has appendix A, B, C, D, etc., right before he actually begins his Perish Mishnayos. Why? So really the best way to explain it is that it's a who's who of all the Chachamim in the Mishnayos. So as we know, we come across all different types of, lack of a better term, characters and personalities inside the Mishnah. So it's important to know, for example, why Abaye is not called Rav Abaye, but just Abaye. Why that guy is called Rav, or that guy is called Rebbe, who the genealogies are, etc., etc. So the Rambam actually goes into, in one appendix, he goes through the various genealogies, like why this guy who's been this guy versus this guy been that guy. Or, for example, the Rambam discusses, like I should have mentioned before, the different prefixes. Why does it say Rav versus Rebbe, okay? Almost like a code that you can use when you go through the Mishnah, so you'll know who's who. And finally, he also mentions as one of the appendixes is the cameos. There are certain people who appear in a Mishnah one time, and I never see them in a Mishnah again. And he wants to explain to you before you get started who those people are. So what the Rambam does before he begins the actual Perish Mishnayos is, he organizes for you who everyone is. All the Rabbanim, every Rav who presents in the Mishnah is listed prior to his first explanation of Mishnayos, and he divides them up categorically based on things like prefixes and genealogies, etc. So it's a great tool to memorize and have when you start reading his Perish Mishnayos.